started moving quicker. And all of a sudden, another one fell out. I looked up the road and saw another body tumble from the back of the truck. It just fell like a sack of wheat onto the road. I didn't know what to do. Once again, I looked down to the air, saw his perforated body, knew that the future of Russia was dead beyond a doubt, and then I gazed up the road at the next dark pile that was yet another Romanov. I started moving, started running to the second body. The truck, oblivious, rumbled on into the madness of the night. Unbelievably, the second body moved and quivered and I wanted to scream out, to beg to God. It was the third child, Grand Duchess Maria, who, by some miracle, was not only still alive, but trying to get up. She hadn't fallen from the truck, but thrown herself, and when I reached her, she was trying to push herself to her knees. Her long, dark skirt was torn, grossly soiled, her light blouse ripped and stained, but she wasn't crying. No, she had quite literally risen from the dead, and she was as stunned as a newborn, shocked, even horrified, to find herself here on this earth. Hearing my quick steps, Maria shook with fear. This most beautiful of girls, this protected princess, opened her mouth to scream. I saw that she was going to howl to the sky and moon and back, and I charged forward. As quickly as I could, I threw my hand over her mouth, gagged her fear, kept it bottled up inside the poor thing. Etaya! It's me, I hissed into her ear. Etaya! I gently lowered her back to the road, and Grand Duchess Maria fell weak and silent beneath my youthful power. She attempted to struggle, but then, gazing up at me with those rich eyes, fell still. Yanka, she gasped, clutching my arm. Like the sternest of schoolmasters, I ordered, keep quiet or they'll come after us both. She understood, of course. At the same time, I saw her eyes strain after the lorry that was carting away her family.
Papa, Mama,
she moaned, her body now falling flaccid in my arms. Only as I held her did I realize how badly she was bleeding. I didn't know if it was a bayonet wound or if a bullet had grazed her temple, but she was bleeding most profusely from the side of her head from just above her ear. I touched her temple, sensed a long, deep wound, and then tore a swath of material from her skirt, which I wrapped around her head. Fearful that the truck would turn around and come back, I tried to help her get up. We've got to get off the road and into the woods, I said. But when she moved, she clutched her side and cried out, I can't! The bullets meant to kill her had instead struck her diamond-studded corset, the force of which had broken a number of her ribs. She started gasping for air, and as I held her, I saw she was bleeding terribly from her left leg as well. Raising her skirt, I saw two wounds in her left thigh, one on the front, the other the back. A bullet had apparently gone through her leg, perhaps shattering the bone. As she leaned upon me, I tore more of her skirt, then tied that strip around the top of her leg, tightening the tourniquet to stem the blood. I glanced way down the road, saw the vague, dark shape of the lorry slowing. Or had it stopped? Panic seized my throat. Had they discovered that not one, but two of the Romanovs had fallen from the back of the vehicle? Were the Reds about to return and hunt us out? I had to get Maria Nikolaevna off the road and hide her in the woods. Somehow, I found this strength. She was a big girl, and I turned around, pulled her up on my back. It was then, as I half-dragged her off the road, that she saw the other body. Alexei. There was no way to soften the truth, not on that night, and I said, Ubiri, they killed him. I kept moving, carrying the Grand Duchess into the woods, which were not really that thick. Behind the clump of bushes I found a pine, and there I placed Maria, lowering her to the sandy ground, and then propping her up against the tree.
"My brother," she begged.
"Umile," I repeated.
I wondered if we shouldn't just leave him for the guards to find. A decoy. And she understood this, the Grand Duchess did, for she saw the hesitation on my face.
"Bring him to me."
In all the time that I'd spent in the House of Special Purpose, I'd never heard any of the royal family issue a command, particularly none of the children. Yet Grand Duchess Maria Nikolaevna so ordered me. Dead or alive, she would not abandon her brother. And so, wasting no time, I darted through the wood and back onto the road. I glanced into the distance, and sure enough, there was the truck, stopped, or perhaps stuck. There was little time, and so I grabbed Alexei by the shoulders and pulled the boy out of the road and into the pine wood, leaving a swerving trail of blood behind. Reaching the trees, I stopped and took off my light jacket, which I in turn draped over the boy's mutilated head. I then dragged him on all the way to Maria, whereupon I laid him by her side. She immediately took his hand, then started to pull away my jacket. It was my turn to order, and this I did, catching her hand, pushing it back, and commanding, "Nyets!" She understood quite clearly, and she laid back, holding his hand, which she pinned to her chest. Her eyes blinked quite heavily, as if she were about to fall into the most permanent sleep. Suddenly her mouth moved, and she begged, "Please, you must go after them, after Tatyana." Tatyana? It couldn't be. My mind exploded. I'd seen her shot. I'd seen that guard attack her with a bayonet. Or was I all wrong? Could she have been protected by her corset as well? I demanded, "She lives as well?" She gazed weakly at me. "You must go. You must bring her." She slipped away then, Maria did. At first, I thought she'd simply expired on the spot, but then I saw her chest rise and fall, albeit quite slowly. Whether she was passing into some kind of shock, or she was about to die, I couldn't tell, but this much I knew. I had to find out if indeed the Tsar's second daughter, Tatyana, was still alive. And so I said, "I'll be back." Her head slowly rose and fell. "Trust me, I'll be back to take care of you. Just don't try to move. Just wait. I'll go see if your sister is... Go," she pleaded with the last of her strength. "Go now." "I'll be back," I chanted yet again, making a pledge as much to myself as to the princess. Those were my last words to her before I scrambled out of the woods. I had no idea how much blood she'd already lost, just as I had no idea how much longer Maria would live. I was so young and knew so little of such things. So I left her. I did exactly as the Grand Duchess begged, no more nor less. I abandoned her, which of course turned out to be the stupidest thing. I followed her command, hurried to the road, whereupon I saw all that blood pooled like motor oil on the dirt. I knew I couldn't leave such an obvious sign, so I returned to the edge of the wood and took a large branch, and this branch I dragged over the blood of Alexei and Maria so as to obscure it, which I did. I swirled the dirt around, buried the redness as best I could, and then I threw the bloodied pine bough into the bushes and started running after the motor lorry, the engine of which coughed and sputtered in the distance. Already the depth of darkness had passed, and in the faintest of early light I could see it, that clumsy truck, laden with all the bodies. I ran and ran, my mind on fire. The vehicle passed over a railway embankment, and I was just catching up when suddenly I heard all this commotion. I heard shouting voices, the stomp of many horses, and I ducked behind a clump of birches. From nowhere, a convoy of men, as many as 20, charged out of the night. Most of them were on horseback, a few in small horse-pulled carts, and they were shouting with the drunken revelry of revolution and murder.
Give us Nikolashka! Off with his capitalist head! Death to the blood drinker!
I quickly understood that this haphazard detachment of Reds had been told they would get the honor of killing the Royal Ones, not simply burying them. When they found out, however, that their hated Nikolashka and his traitorous whore, the German bitch, were already dead, there was a fiery roar of disappointment and anger. One of the men shouted, "We were told you would bring them to us alive! We wanted to kill them!
You tricked us!"
They were so angry and so drunk that a second bloodbath, Commandant Yurovsky's very own, began to quickly boil. Someone fired a shot into the air. Another lowered his pistol and fired into the back of the truck itself. Fearing the worst, Yurovsky shouted, "Long live the revolution!" With that, he ordered the driver, Comrade Lukhanov, to move on. The convoy of men had no choice but to follow the motorized transport, and neither did I. Once they were all well underway, I emerged from behind the birches and ran after them. It was easier, of course, than ever to follow them, for the road was in terrible condition, which forced them to drive slowly. Plus, the men made such racket. In such a way did I follow them for another 20, 30 minutes, when suddenly the lorry came to a sudden halt. The road had narrowed, and the truck itself had become horribly stuck in the mud between two trees. They couldn't budge it, not an inch, for the vehicle had sunk so deep. Sure, there'd been so much rain, and now there was much mud. A whirlwind of shouting ensued. Everyone had an opinion, of course, and Yurovsky and the other fellow in the cab of the truck climbed out. A great effort was made. Everyone pushed, but to no avail. By this time, I was able to get quite close, too close, really, but I was desperate to find out if Tatyana lived as well. I positioned my young body behind a pine, and in the gray morning light I watched as first one, then two men, jumped onto the back of the truck. I think they just wanted to see the bodies with their own eyes. But then, one of the peasant men, groping for the touch of a royal bosom, reached into the bodice of a Grand Duchess and came up not with a breast, but a handful of bloody jewels.
"Brillianti!"
he screamed with shocked glee. With the diamonds finally discovered, a handful of men swarmed over the bodies like hungry maggots. Panicking, Yurovsky started jumping around, shaking his pistol overhead and screaming. He fired once into the air, and the comrades slithered off the truck like scared rats. As for the lorry, it was quite obvious the vehicle was going nowhere. Yurovsky was desperate. Things couldn't be going much worse, and he waved his gun around and ordered the men to transfer the bodies from the lorry to the carts. Because the horse-drawn carts were so small, however, they had to split up the bodies, two on that cart, three on that, one over there, and in that way, Yurovsky didn't realize that Alexei and Maria were missing. Yet. The commandant was so busy waving around his pistol and trying to control these men that he didn't even count all the troopy. Not just then, not just yet. And as soon as he was told the bodies had all been reloaded, off they went in single file through the woods. The morning light was filtering softly through the trees by this time, and soon the mistakes began flowing like a mountain brook. Not 5 minutes passed before this line of murderers and murdered took a wrong path and became lost in the wood. To complicate matters even more, they came upon a group of peasants from the nearby village Koptiki. Threatening these simple people with his pistol, Yurovsky shouted, "There are whites everywhere out here, so you'd better get home before we shoot you all." Finally, just as the northern morning sun was climbing into the sky, this convoy of carts and horses and men reached the ruins of the Four Brothers Mine, named after a cluster of old pines where gold had once been sought. "I want you three men," Yurovsky shouted, his pistol ever in hand, "to patrol the area and shoot anyone on sight." Hearing this, I slunk into some deep bushes, crouched down, and watched the red bastards handle the Imperial family like slaughtered animals. It was a fiasco, a farce right from the beginning. This area, this place, was only a few versts from village Koptiki, a hamlet of a few dozen wood huts, and before the Romanovs were even stripped of their clothing, the entire village knew that their Tsar had been murdered and where he was to be buried. Furthermore, the Four Brothers was an open mine, not a tunnel, but a big hole. It was a pit shaft, actually, and not very deep, not really, maybe some 20 feet at most, and the bottom of it was filled with water, very cold water. In short, it was the stupidest place to think of burying anyone, be he peasant or king. Commandant Yurovsky ordered the bodies unloaded, and the men eagerly swarmed upon Nikolai, Alexandra, the girls, the others. They dragged the Imperial family and their attendants off the carts and threw them in a pile like game from an Imperial hunt. It was then that I realized they were dead, all dead, including, of course, Tatiana. I saw her heaved atop and knew without doubt that she was gone. "I don't want anyone to be able to identify these bodies," shouted the commandant. "So I want you to strip them all. What you can't pull off, we're going to have to cut away." And this these animal men did, pulling and slicing boots and jackets, blouses and shirts from the hated Romanovs. Soon there were diamonds spilling from the corsets into the mud, which sent an electric charge through the men all over again. Working with great frenzy, they found the gold on Alexandra's wrist and the ropes of pearls around her waist. When one of the men couldn't get the ring off Alexandra's finger, the one given to her by her uncle Leo, he took out his knife and cut the finger clean away. Sure, I watched as he yanked the ring free, secretly stuffed it in his pocket, then tossed aside the manicured finger. Months upon months later, Investigator Sokolov, whom the Whites brought in to try to find the Imperial remains, found this very finger, which to this day remains preserved in a jar of alcohol in Paris. Altogether, it didn't take the Red Barbarians long to strip their victims, and soon the Imperial family and their servants were lying about this way and that, naked in the mud. Yurovsky then ordered a big bonfire built, and this his men did as well. They built this fire and threw the clothing into the flames. It was then, of course, that they discovered that two of the Romanovs were missing. Yurovsky, he went crazy. He started running around screaming. He counted the bodies over and over. Then he called for two guards. He gave them two horses and told them to ride off and... Oy, I have lied so much and for so long that I have almost forgotten the real truth, which is so difficult to let pass my lips. But I started running then. I looked back only once. Big Dr. Botkin, two men started to drag his naked body toward the opening of the mine. They each had him by a foot, and they were pulling him face down. Later, much later, the Sokolov man also found Botkin's dentures, all caked with mud. Eggshells, too. Sokolov found lots of eggshells, which turned out to be the very ones the good sister Antonina and novice Marina had brought. Hard cooked, the eggs meant for food for the Romanovs had instead nourished their killers. As for the bodies, well, they were never found there. Later, When Sirovsky and his men had burned all the clothing and had tossed the troupe, the carcasses, into the mine, the guards hurled in hand grenades. But they couldn't seal it up. It was impossible, for the ground was too tough. And this terrible thing that was supposed to be so secret? Well, the four brothers' mine proved to be only the first grave of Tsar Nikolai, his family, and faithful. And it turned out to be their grave for less than 30 hours. Da, da, da. And as those awful men dragged along faithful Dr. Botkin, I ran. I ran through the wood and straight to her, straight to Grand Duchess Maria Nikolaevna, whom I had left bleeding, there in a wood, and against a pine. 19. So I charged through the woods as fast as I could, knowing that anything could happen. I could be caught by the Reds and shot. A villager could see me and turn me in. Maria could be dead by the time I reached her. But I was determined to keep my promise, and I did. I returned to that spot in the pine wood where I had abandoned Grand Duchess Maria. At first, I wasn't sure if she was still alive. She sat just as I had left her, propped up against the tree, her eyes closed, her hands wrapped around her brother's. Rushing up to her, I dropped to my knees, reached out, and gently touched her on the shoulder. Her eyes fluttered, then opened. Ah, my Lyonka. Almost immediately, she drifted away again, tumbled back into shock. Sure, I knew she needed immediate medical help, but I also knew that I had to hide her better. So I picked her up. I picked her up in my arms and carried her as far as I could into the wood. When I could go no more, I found a tree that had been half blown over. Its roots had been lifted up, and there was a den of sorts beneath that. It was into this dark corner that I placed the Grand Duchess. As carefully as I could, I laid her down on the soft dirt floor. She moaned, but nothing more. "I'll be right back," I whispered. Wasting no time, I returned to the heir, whom I also gathered in my arms. I carried him, too. With my jacket over his head, I carried his lifeless body all the way to the hidden den, and there I likewise placed him. Turning to the Grand Duchess, I touched her on the shoulder and said, "I'm back. I brought your brother." But there was no response of any kind. She'd lost so much blood that she was no longer conscious. And I understood she was dying. I didn't want to leave her again, but I had no choice. She needed medical attention. She was dying, and needed care that I didn't know how to give. And so I hid Maria and Alexei. I covered the opening of the den with branches and departed once again. I raced along, thinking I would go directly to Father Starozhev. But as I approached the city, I looked down and saw that my shirt and pants were smeared with blood. There was no way I could go into the center of Yekaterinburg looking like that. I'd be picked up by the Reds in an instant. So I had no choice. I went to my only other friends, the only others I could trust. I went all the way around the edge of town to the monastery, where I found the good Sister Antonina and Novice Marina, who had already tried that morning to bring foodstuffs to the house of special purpose. Instead of being able to deliver their goods, however, they were turned away and told never to return. Not ever. A few hours later, the entire town was abuzz, everyone saying that something horrible had happened to the Tsar and all the rest of us. Upon seeing me and my blood-stained clothes, Sister Antonina gasped and crossed herself, whereas Novice Marina, who'd assumed me dead, all but screamed. "Lyonka, my child," cried the sister, crossing herself. "What's happened?" I started to cry. Immediately, the sister took me into a windowless chamber, and it was there that I explained the events of the night. I sobbed. Sure, with tears in my eyes, I told them of the murders, of how I'd found Alexei and Maria, of what I'd seen at the mine.
and I begged for their help, begged for them to come at once. I don't know how much longer Maria can last. They wasted no time. Sister Antonina and Novice Marina flew into action. They gathered up bandages and other medical things, and I led them around the edge of town and into the wood. All the way there, Sister Antonina kept chanting prayers, begging for God's mercy, and crossing herself. It seemed to take forever, and I worried the whole way that we would be discovered, but finally we made it to the hidden den, where we found the first light in the nightmare.
20.
When I lifted aside the boughs I had placed over the hidden den, the light of God cut through the day and struck her face. Immediately the girl's eyes opened, and the slightest of smiles graced her face. Upon seeing us, Maria said,
"What, brought others to see me, have you, Longa?"
"Everything's going to be all right," calmly replied Sister Antonina. At once the sister, so short and round, descended into the den, and with her merciful hands she started treating the wounded young woman. First she carefully examined the gash on the side of Maria's head. Next she checked the bullet wound in her leg.
"You did very well, Longa, very well indeed," muttered Sister Antonina with approval,
for somehow I had managed to stem the flow of blood. She then turned to Alexei, his head covered by my jacket. And it was just as I had told her, the poor boy was hopelessly dead. This she verified. The sister lifted up a corner of the jacket, gasped, made the sign of the cross, and covered him once again. There was no time to waste in grief, this the old sister clearly knew, and she beckoned her assistant into the den.
"Come, Marina."
The young novice descended, and thereupon the two of them set upon Grand Duchess Maria, cleaning her wounds, bandaging her arm and thigh, and comforting her with their few supplies. The two women of the cloth made an easy team, and their hands worked quickly and confidently. Much to my surprise, it was soon apparent that Sister Antonina knew about the corset of diamonds.
"Let's get this thing off you, Dragaya Maya."
"My dear," said the nun, untying Maria's undergarment,
"lying on all these stones can't be comfortable."
Immediately Maria twisted to the side, and she protested,
"But don't worry, they will be perfectly safe, just like the rest."
At first it didn't make sense. Sure, I knew that Maria, like her sisters, was covered in brillianti. But I didn't understand how Sister Antonina knew about them as well, not at least until the following day. Only then did I learn about everything else, all the jewelry that had been hidden away, the suitcases of Romanov jewels. While one had remained in Tobolsk, the second, weighing over a pud, some 38 pounds, had already been brought to Yekaterinburg. Without turning to me, Sister Antonina ordered, "Longa, my young one, we're going to have to cut away the young woman's corset. Please turn away." I wasn't in the little den. The space just wasn't that big. I was simply looking in through the roots. But rather than turn away, I covered up the little entrance. I laid branches back on the opening and left the sister and novice to attend to the Grand Duchess, which they did very well. They spent a long time cleaning and dressing her wounds and administering what medicaments they had brought. They fed her water, too, and broth and bread. During this entire time, I hid in the wood, but I did not sleep. Yet. I watched. I hid in brush and watched for the Reds, who were sure to sweep the area, searching for the two missing young ones. But the Reds never did come. No. They furiously searched the road and the town, but they never ventured that far into the wood. And in an attempt to cover up his gross error, imagine, he'd lost two bodies. Yurovsky conceived of the famous Yurovsky note, in which he claimed to have burned the two missing bodies. This, however, was yet another clean lie, for virtually no sign of any bodies was ever found. Not even a single bone. It was a stupid lie, too, for it is impossible to completely burn bodies over an open flame. I finally settled against a birch, slumping against its peeling bark. Nearly an entire hour passed before Sister Antonina and Novice Marina emerged from the hidden den. "How is she?" I asked, rushing up to them. Will she live?
She rests comfortably now, replied Sister, and with the grace of God, all will be well.
Slava Bogu. Thank God. Now it is time to bury the little one. Would you be so kind as to fetch him, Lonka?
And that I did. I fetched the body of my friend and master, the heir Tsarevich Alexei Nikolaevich. His sister Maria had fallen into the deepest of sleeps, and so it was just the sister, novice, and I who blessed him and gave him back to the earth. I carried him out of the den and laid him on the ground. As the two women cleaned and comforted his horribly damaged body, Sister Antonina ripped away part of her own garments and wrapped him in it, I carved his grave in front of a clump of three white birches. But it was not a deep grave, merely adequate, a shallow wound, since all I had to dig with were several branches and my bare hands. Then, as the sister chanted prayers and blessings, Novice Marina and I buried the boy, though we did not make a cross.
Better that we not mark the spot, recommended Sister Antonina.
And she was right at that. We put the boy to rest there in the soil of his holy Mother Asha, the very soil which he himself had been born to protect, then covered him and hid the grave beneath branches and leaves so that the Reds could never find him, never bother him again. And he lies there, hidden in that wood, undisturbed today. Of that I am quite sure. Then Sister Antonina scurried off to check on Maria. Like a mole dressed in black, the sister crawled into the hiding spot beneath the tree roots. When she emerged a few minutes later, however, the concern was rippling across her face.
She rests well, but her wounds weep oddly, and I worry of infection, reported the old nun. I must return to town for more medicaments. Marina, you are to stay by the girl's side. And Lonka?
I will guard them both.
Excellent.
She turned to go, and over her shoulder called, I will be back before the fall of night.
That was her promise, but sadly, those were her last words to us.
Neither Novice Marina nor I were ever to see her again, for someone informed on Sister Antonina. Some red spy saw her creeping back into the town, saw her torn, dirtied habit, and knew something was up. And so Yurovsky sent his henchmen, those thugs from the Cheka, the political police of the Reds, to question her. They found fear in her eyes and blood on her garments, and they brought her in. Not a thing would she tell them, however, not even when they tortured her. They asked and pushed and cut on her, but she didn't say anything about the heir or Grand Duchess, of course, or even the fortune of gems. 2 days later, rather than waste a bullet on her, the Reds tied a heavy metal stove grating to her and dropped her to the bottom of the river Itysk.
Yes, such terrible things that went on.
Ever hopeful, however, Novice Marina and I waited, watching and attending to the Grand Duchess's every need. Night came and passed. So arrived the next day, still there was no Sister Antonina. We knew something was wrong, terribly wrong. And yet, by sunfall, we had even a worse problem. Grand Duchess Maria had developed a very sudden, very high fever. Within an hour's time, she started to burn up.
Get me some fresh, cool water, Lonka, demanded Novice Marina, quickly.
I rushed to a nearby stream and fetched nice cold water, which we fed the Grand Duchess and used to cool her brow. But it was not enough. Her temperature kept rising. The very following day we were so worried that I snuck into town myself. I left Marina and the Tsar's daughter and went off in search of the medicaments. Of course I was very careful, and in my own secret way I found the path to the Church of the Ascension. I wanted to speak to Father Staruzhev, but he was off at the jail, trying in vain to win the freedom of Sister Antonina, who was then still alive. Not trusting anyone else, I left, having found nothing with which to heal the Grand Duchess. My thought was that I would return to the church the next day, and so I headed back to the wood, bringing with me only some cheese and bread.
Our only hope, it seemed, was to keep Maria strong enough that she might live yet another 24 hours. Instead, her temperature kept rising, and she ceased taking even water. By the following morning, her breathing had grown more difficult, and she was lingering on the very edge of life itself. Both Marina and I understood the end was at hand. Kneeling beside the Grand Duchess, I clutched her hand. Novice Marina knelt next to me, chanting prayers and crossing herself repeatedly.
Lonechka,
Maria said, opening her eyes and using the softest diminutive of my name,
thank you for watching over me. This is all my fault,
I confessed, my eyes flooding like the mightiest of Siberian rivers.
Your father entrusted me with a note which I failed to deliver. I'm sure it fell into the hands of the Reds and—
Shh,
my friend, there's no need for that.
My tears came stronger than ever, and I bowed my head before the last of the imperial family. Did she not know? Did she not see what role I had played in the end of her entire family? Had the shock of that night wiped clean her memory?
You don't understand, Maria Nikolaevna. I understand everything.
No, no, you don't. I was supposed to deliver that note. I was supposed to rally the 300 officers.
Yes, and this you try to do with all your heart. The Lord God sent you to try to save us, and this you attempted. Father was most grateful for your help.
No! Maria Nikolaevna, no! You don't understand,
I pleaded, bowing my head over and over to her.
I failed!
You do not understand.
I understand that you blame yourself for events beyond your control. Please, forgive me.
There is nothing to forgive.
But— I clutched Maria's hand as tightly as I could. As she faded away, I tried to tether her to this world. But she did not want to be kept here. Maria's eyes then closed and slowly opened, and she said,
300 years ago, my family made this country strong and stable, but we should have left long ago. Better I should die. Better we should fade away.
No, pleaded Novice Marina, breaking her chanting. Do not leave us, Your Highness.
Yet perhaps she was correct. Perhaps Maria was wise in her words, for she clearly understood that the time of the Romanovs was finished. Besides, who knew what would have happened had the last daughter of the last Tsar survived? I don't think she could have rallied the troops, for she was too young. Rather, I think she would have rallied only confusion and despair. Meanwhile, every Bolshevik on earth would have hunted her and any future offspring down.
The Grand Duchess faded into delirium, and just when I thought we lost her, she rallied her strength. Beckoning the novice and me closer, Maria Nikolaevna commanded us with what would be the greatest tasks of our lives.
Marina, began the Grand Duchess, her voice so very faint,
you perhaps know where our riches are hidden here in town?
Das, Vashe Velichestva.
Yes, Your Highness, replied the young woman. I am aware of what we have guarded at our monastery.
Then this you must do. You and Lyonka must gather it all, every bit that is here in Yekaterinburg, and if you can, that which is still in Tobolsk. You must then bury it all away again. You must keep it someplace safe. And once this terror has left our land, and once my family has had a proper Orthodox burial, then I beg you to return all of these treasures to the people of my country. It is to be a gift from my family to our people. Understood?
Das, both the novice and I replied. And so it was that Grand Duchess Maria Nikolaevna, third daughter of Nikolai and Alexandra, married the novice Marina and me in both duty and fate. Which is to say that we both escaped that time and place with one entire suitcase of Romanov jewels, which we have ever since guarded so carefully. You see, as we fled through the Siberian woods to Shanghai, and eventually America, I, Lyonka, became Misha, whereas Marina became May, and jointly in time, we became husband and wife. But that fateful morning, Maria Nikolaevna lasted only moments longer. She, who was born in a golden palace, expired shortly thereafter on a pile of leaves, there in that filthy den of tree roots. I myself was clutching her hand when she opened her eyes for the last time. Our eyes met and held, and I understood she was leaving. "Yet," I cried, falling upon her. That was how I caught her last breath. She exhaled, I breathed in, and she was gone. That peacefully, that easily. And so ended the family of the last Tsar, the humble Tsar Nikolai II, and his devoted consort, Tsaritsa Alexandra. Amin.
21. But, Katya, moya dragaya vnuchka, Kate, my dear granddaughter, continued Misha, seated at his office desk, and clutching the microphone in both hands, that's not quite the end, for the Romanovs have now been buried a total of 3 times. In other words, Russia still does not know what to do with her last Tsar, and where to place him in her ugly history. Yes, such devilish things have been done to the bodies of the Tsar and his family. Misha sighed, caught his breath, and gazed at his wall of books on the Romanovs. He was almost done, almost to the end, determined to make his granddaughter understand the complexities of the revolution and the fall of the Tsar. And he was doing just that, wasn't he? Well, the very day after they were dumped down that mine, the Tsar and his family were brought back to the surface of the world again. Yes, it's true, we learned all this not only from the Yurovsky Note of 1920, but also from those guards, who were later thoroughly interrogated by the whites. And that next day the Romanovs were indeed resurrected. Because so many townspeople knew what had happened and where the bodies of Nikolai, Alexandra, and the others were buried, the Commandant Yurovsky recognized the necessity of transferring the corpses to another location. On top of that, Yurovsky's idiots, those Reds, had made such a mess of the area at the Four Brothers Mine that even a blind man could have found the bodies. So, Yurovsky and his men returned to the mine and fished out the Romanovs. One of the Bolsheviki was lowered to the bottom of the pit shaft, where he stood in freezing water up to his waist. He started with Tatiana, tying a rope around her young, naked body. Giving a signal, the young princess was then hoisted up. And so it went, one by one. And because the bodies had been in this chilled, fresh water, they were all pink and fresh-looking like naked babies, their cheeks nice and rosy. They were all pulled out, of course except the tiny dog Jimmy, who was found only months later nearly perfectly preserved. Oy, it was such a farce. What idiots those Reds were. They tossed the murdered ones in the back of a truck and headed off, intending to bury them in a deeper mine near the Siberian highway. Along the way, however, the motor lorry kept sinking in the mud because, of course, it had rained so much. Finally, it went in up to its axles, becoming hopelessly mired. The Reds jumped out of the truck, scratched their stupid heads for a few minutes, and then pushed and pushed to no avail. Eventually, Yurovsky decided they needed to lighten the load, and so they pulled off the bodies, tossing the Tsar and his family on the side of the road like a pile of logs. Again, they pushed and pushed, this time freeing the vehicle. By then,
It was dawn of yet another day, and Yurovsky and his idiots were so exhausted. Do you know what they did? They threw the Romanovs and their retinue in the shallow, muddy hole left by the truck. True. It's true, Katya. Yurovsky thought himself so smart, pleased, that they were killing two hares with one shot. And so they tossed them in the shallow hole, Romanov and servant piled this way and that, and then they doused them with sulfuric acid to make them unrecognizable. Finally, they covered them with mud and clay, threw some railroad ties over this grave, and ran the motor lorry back and forth to pack everything down. Can you imagine? And it worked. It worked for almost 75 years. Investigator Sokolov searched the entire area and even had his picture taken standing atop those very railroad ties, but never thought to look beneath them. Caught up in his anger, Misha fell silent. He could go on for hours. So many stories, so many horrors. But enough. He was so tired. So very, very tired. But here, Daragaya, I must draw to a close. He took a deep breath, gathered all his energy just to hold himself together. And so, this is my story, the one I have never been able to tell. I apologize. I apologize for my lies, but we were so afraid, your grandmother and I. You must understand that she was but a simple novice, so sweet, so pretty, and I was just a plain kitchen boy. And these things we could not tell you, because we were ever afraid of the Bolsheviki, ever afraid that they would not only come after us, but later, after both you and your father. This was a real danger, too, because the Reds were doing this. They were going after Russians everywhere, even killing one of their own, that communist Trotsky, in Mexico. This is exactly why the Tsar's sisters fled so far as well, Ksenia to England, and Olga eventually to Canada, where, of course, she died above that tiny barber shop. But I apologize, both for me and your Baba Maya. Because of our fears, we presented ourselves to you as a lie. Yes, my beloved wife was none other than the young, innocent novice Marina. Well, my dear, I shall end now. I've instructed my lawyer not to give you this tape, nor the key and combination to my vault, until I have died. Which means that by the time these words reach your ears, I will have left this earth to join your grandmother. Be confident, my sweet one, in our love for you. Be strong in our faith in your abilities. There is nothing more precious in the world than you, our lovely granddaughter. Not even the Romanov gems that you will soon see. Since the early death of your father, my son, 17 years ago, you have burned like a bright star in our lives, your grandmother's and mine. Our sincerest thanks for restoring in part our belief in the goodness of the world. Oh, but I hesitate to say goodbye. Suddenly, he felt hot tears flood his eyes, and he crudely blotted at them. There are so many more stories, so much more to tell. His voice began to quiver. But enough, enough. Я тебя очень люблю. I love you very much. Realizing that he could no longer control himself, the old man quickly flicked off the tape recorder. He mopped his eyes, then slumped forward, resting his forehead in the heels of his worn hands. It had been harder than he thought, but he'd done it, gotten through it all. Yes, he'd given his granddaughter 1,000 truths. He wanted to sit there basking in his memories, both horrific and wonderful. But now was no time to linger. He was so close, so very close, and he had so little left to do. Pushing himself on, Misha popped the cassette out of the small black machine. He picked up his gold pen, gathered his thoughts and energy, and on the tape itself wrote,
for our Katya. He then slipped the tape into the envelope he'd already addressed to his granddaughter, sealed it, and placed the packet in the center of his desk. Sure, he thought. Everything was in order. He'd gone through all his papers, all his files. He wanted to leave behind as clean a trail as possible. There was no sense in making this difficult for Kate. No sense making it more complicated than it already was, or would be. Misha rolled back his chair, braced himself, and then pushed himself to his feet. He sensed himself teetering and leaned over, placing both hands on his desk. So old, he thought. So much time had passed. So many things had happened. Sometimes he felt like he could live another century. Other times, like now, he felt as if he had but minutes left. As he carefully moved to his built-in bookcase, a jolt of pain bit his left knee, his bad one, and he stood still. Then proceeded. Reaching into his pocket, he pulled out a key, one that he always carried on his person. He next reached up to the wall of books, where he pushed aside two volumes and revealed a brass lock. When Misha inserted his key and turned it, a well-oiled and well-balanced 3-foot section of the entire bookcase, stretching from floor to ceiling, began to swing out. He pulled it fully open, revealing yet another door, a metal one, with a brass handle and a dial lock. He'd had this hidden vault installed 60 years ago, when May and he had bought this house. Now he spun the dial to 4 numbers, 1, 8, 9, 4, the year of the Tsar's ascension to the throne, and immediately there was a gentle pneumatic sound and the door moved slightly. Misha pulled on the handle, swinging forward the thick, heavy door. The first thing he did was hit a light switch, revealing a walk-in safe, some 6 feet deep and 5 feet wide. The only other person in the family to know of its existence was, of course, May, and together they had come in here 3 or 4 times a year, not simply to check on things, but to marvel at the treasures and bathe in bittersweet memories. Misha had never worried about being robbed. If the house had been broken into, the thieves would have gotten only the inconsequential stuff, the silver flatware, the tea set, some of May's day-to-day jewels, but not this, the secret heart of his life's work. At first glance, the contents of the vault seemed pathetic, for on the left hung a rack of old clothes, a raincoat, suit, and pants for him, a dress, hat, and a coat for Maya. On the right stood a rack of shelves filled from floor to ceiling with boxes, some small, some large. Beneath them, resting on the floor, were 3 banker's boxes that contained sundry documents. In the beginning, May and he had sold hardly any of it, no more than a small bag or two of insignificant diamonds. They'd used that money not only to escape Russia, but to launch their lives in America. Later on, of course, Misha had sold more of the loose gems, none of them of historical value, using the cash to buy sundry Fabergé items that the cash-poor Soviets, not to mention the defrocked Russian princes, were selling all across Europe. Oh, yes, thought Misha, reaching for a box on the 4th shelf. He quite liked this one. And he pulled the cardboard box halfway out, opened the lid, and revealed a gray jeweler's bag inside. Flipping that open, he gazed upon a Fabergé box some 12 inches long and 4 inches deep that was covered with lapis and diamonds. Before it was hidden away here, it had sat for several decades on Tsar Nikolai's desk. Fabergé had been a master of combining styles from different periods, turning objets d'art into functional things of beauty, what he termed objets de fantaisie. Oh, and this one, thought Misha, as he closed up that box and reached for another. This one was May's favorite. Lifting another jeweler's bag into his hands, he felt something heavy and egg-shaped, which he slid into his palm. It was a large gold egg encrusted with a multitude of double-headed eagles, the emblem of Imperial Russia, that were fashioned out of platinum and hundreds of diamonds. And, like all of the 56 eggs Fabergé had created for the Imperial family, this one, too, contained a surprise. Misha tipped back the top of the egg, and a diamond-encrusted Orthodox cross popped up. It made him laugh, just like it always did. Created as an Easter present to mark Alexandra's conversion to Russian Orthodoxy, the egg had the year 1896 drawn in rubies on the back. Upward of 12 Fabergé eggs had vanished during the flames of the revolution,
And yet Misha and May had secretly managed to obtain 7 of those. And all 7 of them were in here. Reaching for the box to his right, Misha opened it, revealing another egg, this one in green enamel atop a solid gold pedestal. Flowers fashioned from gold and platinum, rubies, sapphires, and of course diamonds covered the egg. When Misha tipped back its lid, he found a gold perfume bottle inside, its cupola top encrusted with a frosting of tiny diamonds. He gently laid it down, then quickly opened the lid of the next 2 boxes. Opening the inner boxes of each, Misha reached in and felt the shapes of 2 more eggs swathed in jeweler's bags. Without even opening them, he turned his attention to the smaller box on the next shelf down. Opening the cotton bag inside, Misha slipped a diamond some 2 inches in diameter into his palm. He slid the diamond back in its bag and surveyed the wall of shelves. 5 shelves, to be exact, all lined with similar boxes, some 60 or 70. It was all here, the contents of the entire suitcase he and May had carried out of Russia, all of the gems carefully catalogued and packed. Many, he knew, dated back to the time of Peter the Great. 1 piece of jewelry, an emerald the size of a silver dollar that was in turn surrounded by a halo of 20-carat diamonds, had been a gift to Ivan the Terrible. Incomparable treasures, all of them. Collecting and guarding them had occupied nearly his entire life, and now that he had succeeded in his duties, he felt, surprisingly, a sense of pride. He had pledged to bury these things away not only until the fall of communism, but until his Nikolai and Alexandra received a proper Orthodox burial. And now that these both had happened, what miracles! He could rest with a degree of peace. His beloved Kate would have to oversee the final step, returning all of this to Russia, and he had every confidence that she would execute the transfer in a timely manner. This room held the climax of his story and his life, thought Misha. Everything he recorded on that tape was to prepare his granddaughter for this room and its priceless contents. How much was all this worth? 300, 400, $500 million? $1 billion? Certainly somewhere in that range. And that was his reason for telling Kate his version of the final days of the Tsar, simply so that she could and would understand the meaning, the purpose, and the true value of all these jewels in this room. Misha was laying at Kate's feet not unfathomable wealth, but overwhelming, mind-boggling responsibility, and he had to make sure she understood every ramification. As much as he wanted to go through every box and admire every gem, there just wasn't time. It had taken years for May and him to catalog it all, examining and weighing every stone, describing every objet, and then recording it all in a jewel book. May even insisted on drawing a facsimile of every piece, which she carefully did, and that log was there, right over there on the shelf. "Oy, so many memories," mused Misha as he closed the boxes one after the other. He even started laughing. Turning, he looked at the rack of old clothes and chuckled aloud. May and he had been so very afraid, not just in the 20s and 30s, but especially right after World War II and into the 50s. Accordingly, they had taken every precaution, and Misha reached for his raincoat, finding it oddly heavy. Squishing the material between his fingertips, he sensed a band of small, hard objects running all the way around the neck. Stones. And not mere stones, but diamonds. Similarly, May's dress over there held an entire panel of secret brillianti, and the hem a great circle of them. Scattered through these clothes were some 10 pounds of gems, hidden away like this in case May and he had suddenly needed to flee. In a separate codicil to his will, he'd left note of this, too, so Kate wouldn't simply throw these clothes in a bag and drop them at the Goodwill. But enough of this. He had to be going. His end was imminent. There were but 2 things Misha wanted from this room, and he reached for the banker's box on the floor and pushed aside its cardboard lid. Inside, carefully wrapped in cotton towels, he found a small red tin box, a bit rusty at the edges, its cover embossed with the imperial double-headed eagle, and lettering that read, «Tovaryshestvo А.И. Абрикосова в Москве», «The Goods of the А.И. Абрикосова Company, Moscow».
Opening the old candy box, Misha gazed down upon its contents. Some bits of wire, a tiny chain, two small rocks, a flattened coin,